Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast. Golly, that was a bit of a disaster. The podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I was trying to put my phone away and I dropped it. And that made the camera activate for some reason. And then all hell broke loose. And now everyone's dead. Great. Good work, me. I might be exaggerating a little bit. Today we are talking about The Enormous Room, Chapter 12, Part 1. But all the subreddit is abuzz with the conversation of what we're reading next. Anna Karenina. A lot of people jumping over from the A Year of War and Peace subreddit. Actually, I've just had a look at the numbers. We've gained about 250 subscribers overnight. So quite a few people jumping over. So welcome to the newbies. They're probably not listening to this episode because we're not talking about Anna Karenina yet. So they're not going to tune into an episode which is about the last chapter of a book they're not reading. But still, if you are listening, welcome. It's all the rage, the conversation. What version to read? Captain Lush. Captain Lush. Hi, everyone. This is my first time participating in a Reddit book club. I have the Joel Carmichael translation. Never heard of it. Captain Lush. Never heard of the Joel Carmichael translation, which I really enjoyed. I got halfway through the book in the past and had to put it down because of a career shift that took away my reading time. It's a great translation. Very easy and enjoyable to read. I'm very excited to pick it up again. Question about the book club structure. By when are we supposed to have how much of the book read? Good question. We are going to be reading one chapter per day. I actually haven't crunched the numbers, so I don't have an answer for you on that. I don't know how many chapters the book has. So, I don't know. I'm just flicking through my book now and it doesn't have that in the contents. But they are quite short chapters, which is, I think it's good. I think conversation goes better with shorter chapters. One thing I learned over a year of War and Peace is that the short chapters made for really good conversation. And so the typical chapter, well, I'm just looking at the first couple, and they're all about probably 3 pages long, 3 or 4 pages. The first one's 2.5, the second chapter's 3.5, the next one is about 5 by the looks of it. So it's only about 10 or 15 minutes of reading a day, if that. So that's a good thing, that's cool. So the structure is we're just going to move very slowly through the book, one chapter per day. At that rate, I would say we're going to be reading this book, it's quite a big book, for a few months. I would say maybe even 5 months, or something like that. That's a complete guess. I don't know how many chapters there are. But if someone wants to go out there and crunch the numbers for me, I would really appreciate that. Any listeners who feel like doing a little bit of maths? Techrific, don't do it. I know Techrific's listening right now and he's like, oh, I'll do it. And it's not that I don't think you do a good job, but you do everything on this subreddit. And yeah, you put your hand up for everything, which I really appreciate. But I just want, whenever I ask, put out like a little, oh, someone should do this, it's always Techrific that ends up doing it. I feel bad. Because, well, let's be honest, the reason I say things like that is because I'm too lazy to do the research myself as the host of the podcast. That is atrocious behavior. A lot of conversation about which translations to read. I am going to be reading the Maud translation, which I am 90% sure exists. I said that in yesterday's episode, and I said I'd go and do some research. And after having done extensive research, I am still not entirely sure if it exists. If you look at a list of books that Maud translated, Anna Karenina is not in that list. If you look up English public domain versions of Anna Karenina, there is no Maud translation in that list. If you look up Anna Karenina Maud translation, you will find a copy of it, apparently translated in 1918, which would put it in the public domain. but you can't find it in the public domain. So I'm really confused about this Maud version. But apparently it's out there. Wordsworth Classics does it in Maud. Oxford Classics does it in Maud. Dover Thrift, I think, does it in Maud. So we'll be doing it in Maud. Long story short, I read War and Peace in Maud, and it was really, really good. I really enjoyed reading that book. Okay, P and V is a popular translation. Garnet, a lot of people going with that because it's the one that's easy to find in the public domain. I wouldn't recommend Garnet. I don't particularly like Garnet translations, but it is free and easy to find. There's plenty of versions around. I wonder if there's a... who's that other one that did the popular one? There was P&V, and there's another contemporary to P&V who does translations, a more modern person. Name escapes me. It doesn't matter. What are we talking about? Let's talk about the book we're here to talk about. The Enormous Room, Chapter 12, Part 1. What do you think of the three wise men? It seems even Cummings is getting impatient with his descriptions of new characters. And what was the most memorable part of this chapter for you? Nifty Rufix said, "We done witnessed a murder, y'all. I ask the listeners of the podcast, would Ander have shown mercy to that insect had Amazon not annoyed him so? Thoughts?" Tech Rufix says, "Lol, I see it as a crime passionnel. Mitigating circumstances." Thank you, Terrific, for mitigating my circumstances. Nifty Rific said, "Perhaps we should consider it self-defense. I do believe the fauna of Australia to be a varied and dangerous sort." True. Yeah, true. It was a blowfly, not a march fly. But we have what's called a march fly. That's probably everywhere in the world, or maybe it's an Australian thing. I don't know. But they bite you and it bloody well hurts. March flies, they're a pain in the... Well, they're a pain in wherever they bite you. March fly. Is it an Australian thing? It looks like it might be an Australian thing. They're big and they're buggers. Something like a horse fly, also known as a horse fly. But I think the march fly is an Australian thing. There you go. Claim to fame. This pain in the ass. They're like, you know, you've got a fly, then you've got a blow fly, which is bigger, and then you've got a march fly, which is big enough to basically have teeth. I'm not sure if... I don't think it was one of them last night. I think it was just a big blowfly. But yeah, it had to die. It had to die. But I think Nifty Rific wiped me right. I think Amazon... Recounting the Amazon fiasco made me... As you all know, it upsets me. I'm very sensitive. I get upset easily. Amazon did me dirty. Got me all upset. And then in comes a little fly buzzing around my head and just chose the wrong moment to do that. If I'm honest. Techrific said, "Yes, and how even the flora can kill you down under." And Nifty-rific has linked us to a YouTube channel, YouTube show, Conan Learns How to Survive in the Australian Bush. I bet that's really funny. Techrific said, "Yep, a 10 kilogram bunya nut on the old noodle and bye-bye world." Yeah, no kidding. People have died that way. People have died all kinds of way in Australia. We're very inventive in that respect. I made a comment in the subreddit which says this: "That insect was so big it probably had a full name, but yeah, Amazon hit a nerve and Joseph McLaughlin the 70th paid the price." Nifty Rific said, "R.I.P. Joseph McLaughlin the 70th. That's none of that has anything to do with the book. But in yesterday's episode I did have to stop reading to kill a bug. I felt bad for the guy with his hat in his hand. Says, "I am Norwegian, trying to assert himself as innocent, only to be pelted with accusations of the form, 'Well, you're in here, so obviously you're guilty of something.'" Yeah, that was very frustrating to read, that bit of the chapter, where, yeah, they just kind of wouldn't listen. And the more, like, what do you do in that situation? Because if you kick up a fuss, they're not gonna come around, you know. So you can only stay calm and take their punishment, but it's undeserved punishment. It's a very frustrating thing. Cummings managed to stay composed, but I'd be better served But I think he'd be better served smuggling out some letters rather than seeking justice from these three wise men. Says I am Norwegian. Nifty-rific said the most memorable part of the chapter for me was Cummings taking leave of La Commission, especially when he bowed as he might bow to someone who said he was sorry he couldn't give a match, and his disemboweling grin to the other guy. Disemboweling grin. Tegrific said, thinking. Nifty-rific said, of what possibly that'd be like. I practiced a little myself. No one answered my question that I asked mid-reading about when he said there was 8 or 10 women. And it just annoyed me that he went... No, sorry, he said there was 10 or 8 women. Right? That was what he said. And it just annoyed me so bad that he said the higher number first. Like, you know when someone says, oh, there was about 8 or 9 of them. When they say 8 or 10, that also irks me because it's like, why don't you just say... about 9 then, like if it's 8 or 10 ish, just say about 9. But then he says 10 or 8. He goes the higher number first. Who goes the higher number first? I'm still thinking about that 24 hours later. God. Anyway, another thing, Keefy247, new face in the subreddit, posted something really cool. Thank you very much for doing this, Keefy247. They've posted a link to the first first chapter of Anna Karenina in 5 different translations, 5 different English translations. So you can compare and, choose which one you think is best for you. Tigers Come at Night says, reading the Maud translation now. Everyone wants to read the best version. Read a couple of them yourselves and decide for yourself. I mean, read the whole book. You're not wasting anything. It will be enlightening. I would agree to an extent with that, but also do put some effort into choosing one that you like best. Yeah, I'd say I do agree with that. But choosing the wrong one can really ruin a book. On the other hand, I read the version of The Brothers Karamazov that I read 2 books ago was just atrocious, and it ruined the book for me. So, I would say do a little bit of research to choose the one that suits you best. I read Maud version of War and Peace, and it's really good. It's really quite clean and simple. Tolstoy writes very long and convoluted sentences, and there's only so much you can do to translate that out. So those sentences remain intact and long and convoluted in the Maud translation. But at the same time, it's a very simple language and very easily readable. His syntax might take a little bit of getting used to, but it's very clean. You don't have to like iron out the kinks in the sentences. So Maud. And then you've got your P&V, where I know P&V simplifies it quite a lot. And so those long, convoluted sentences, I think they actually, I don't think they break them up into multiple sentences, but I do think that they kind of rearrange them a little bit to make them less complex, less convoluted. So they restructure the sentences in some respects. So it depends how much of a purist you want to be about it, but Maud is very close to the original. You can't go wrong. Maud or P&V, I think you can't go wrong. I would probably not recommend Garnet, but go and have a look. I'm actually going to have a little look at this link right now and just see which ones are included. We've got Garnet, P&V, Maud, and then a revised Garnet, and then Bartlett. Oh, Bartlett did a War and Peace one as well. There you go. I haven't heard much about Bartlett. Cool. All right. It's funny that we're all so excited to start Anna Karenina. I think it might be one of the highlights of the Hemingway list, Anna Karenina. So I'm definitely excited to start. And we're all a little bit sick of The Enormous Room. We've been in this jail for too long now. We're ready to break free. So with that in mind, let's continue and read. What are we reading here? Part 2 of Chapter 12. Which is called, words. I suppose it doesn't matter what it's called, does it? You already know what chapter 12 is called. It's called Three Wise Men. All right, and it goes like this. Poor Monsieur Peters came out of the commission looking extraordinarily épate. Questioned, he averred that his penchant for inventing force pumps had prejudiced, says Messieurs, in his disfavour, and shook his poor old head and sniffed hopelessly. Mexicu exited in a placidly cheerful condition, shrugging his shoulders and remarking, I no do nothing. These fellas tell me wait a few days after you go free. Whereas Pete looked white and determined and said little, except in Dutch to the young skipper and his mate, which pair took La Commission more or less as a healthy bull calf takes nourishment. There was little doubt that they would refind La Liberté in a short while, judging from the inability of the three wise men to prove them even suspicious characters. The Zulu added a few inscrutable gestures, made entirely of silence, and said he would like us to celebrate the accomplishment of this ordeal by buying ourselves and himself a good fat cheese apiece. His friend the young Pole looked as if the ordeal had scared the life out of him temporarily. He was unable to say whether or no he and mon ami would leave us. La Commission had adopted, in the case of these twain, an in awe-inspiring taciturnity. Jean Le Negre, who was one of the last to pass, had had a tremendously exciting time, due to the fact that Le Gouvernement Francais polished tools had failed to scratch his mystery, either in French or English. He came dancing and singing toward us, then suddenly suppressing every vestige of emotion, solemnly extended for our approval a small scrap of paper on which was written Calais, remarking, Que est ce que ça veut dire? And when we read the word for him, Mien vais à Calais, moi travailler à Calais très bon. With a jump and a shout of laughter, pocketing the scrap and beginning the song of songs, Après la guerre finite. A trio which had been hit and hard hit by the three wise men were, or was, the Wanderer and the Machine Fixer and Monsieur Auguste. The former, having been insulted in respect to Chocolat's mother, who also occupied the witness stand, and having retaliated as nearly as we could discover with a few remarks straight from the shoulder apropos justice. O Wanderer, did you expect honour among the honourable? The Machine Fixer, having been told to shut up in the midst of a passionate plea for mercy, or at least fair play, if not in his own case, in the case of the wife who was crazed by his absence, Monsieur Auguste, having been asked, as he had been asked 3 months before by the Honourable Commissioners, why did you not return to Russia with your wife and your child at the outbreak of the war? And having replied with tears in his eyes and that gentle ferocity of which he was occasionally capable, because I didn't have the means, I am not a millionaire, sirs. The baby snatcher, the trick raincoat, the messenger boy, the fighting sheeny, and similar gentry passed the commission without the slightest apparent effect upon their disagreeable personalities. It was not long after Bill the Hollander's departure that we lost the two delectable mountains in the Wanderer and Surplice. Remained the Zulu and Jean Le Negre, B, and I spent most of our time, when on promenade, collecting rather beautifully hued leaves in La Cour. These leaves were inserted in one of my notebooks, along with all the colours which we could find on cigarette boxes, chocolate wrappers, labels of various sorts, and even postage stamps. We got a very brilliant red from a certain piece of cloth. Our efforts puzzled everyone, including the plantons, more than considerably, which was natural, considering that everyone did not know that by this exceedingly simple means we were effecting a study of colour itself, in relation to what is popularly called abstract, and sometimes non-representative, painting. Despite their natural puzzlement, everyone, plantons excepted, was extraordinarily kind and brought us often a valuable additions to our chromatic collection. Had I at this moment and in the city of New York the complete confidence of 1/20th as many human beings, I should not be so inclined to consider the great American public as the most aesthetically incapable organization ever created for the purpose of perpetrating defunct ideals and ideas. But of course, the great American public has a handicap which my friends at La Ferté did not, as a rule, have: education. Let no one sound his indignant yawp at this. I refer to the fact that for an educated gent or lady to create, it is first of all to destroy. That there is and can be no such thing as authentic art until the bond's truce, whereby we are taught to see and imitate on canvas and in stone and by words this so-called world, are entirely and thoroughly and perfectly annihilated by the vast and painful process of unthinking, which may result in a minute bit of purely personal feeling, which minute bit is art. Ah, well, the revolution, I refer, of course, to the intelligent revolution, is on the way, is perhaps nearer than some think, is possibly knocking at the front doors of the great Mr. Harold Bell Wright and the great little Miss Pollyanna. In the course of the next 10,000 years, it may be possible to find delectable mounds without going to prison, captivity, I mean, Monsieur Le Surveillant. It may be possible, I dare say, to encounter delectable mountains who are not in prison. The autumn wore on. Rain did from time to time not fall, from time to time a sort of unhealthy, almost light leaked from the large uncrisp corpse of the sky, returning for a moment to our view the ruined landscape. From time to time the eye travelling carefully with a certain disagreeable, suddenly fear. Travelling carefully with a certain disagreeable, suddenly fear, no longer distance of distances of air. What? From time to time the eye, travelling carefully with a certain disagreeable, suddenly fear, no longer distances of air. That's what it says. Coldish and sweet, stopped upon the incredible clearness of the desolate, without motion, autumn. I think he's just mentioned, like, the intelligent, and I think he's trying to include himself in that by, like, getting all creative with his sentences, but they're just bad sentences. This thing that writers sometimes do when they're like, oh, I'm going to be a genius now, and they try to, like, be called a genius. Like, they write in such a way hoping that someone will be like, wow, what a genius. And they get all, like, flowy and flowery, and it's just it's so ugly. Because why did he suddenly just start writing, like, suddenly the sentences go all, rain did from time to time not fall from time to time. A sort of unhealthy, almost light leaked from the large uncrisp corpse of the sky, returning for a moment to our view the ruined landscape. Like, out of nowhere. Why did you just turn that on? Is it because you mentioned the intelligent revolution, and now you're trying to be part of it? From time to time the eye, travelling carefully with a certain disagreeable, suddenly fear, no longer distances of air, coldish and sweet, stopped upon the incredible clearness of the desolate without motion autumn. That's the sentence. I've read that correctly. God. Awkward and solemn clearness, making louder the unnecessary cries, the hoarse laughter of the invisible harlots in their muddy yard, pointing a cool actual finger at the silly and ferocious group of man-shaped beings, huddled in the mud under four or five little trees, came strangely in my own mind pleasantly to suggest the ludicrous and hideous and beautiful antics of the insane. Frequently I would discover so perfect a command over myself as to reduce La Promenade easily to a recently invented mechanism, or to the demonstration of a collection of vivid and unlovely toys around and around, which, guarding them with impossible heroism, funnily moved purely unreal plantons, always absurdly marching the maimed and stupid dolls of my imagination. I think he may have had a stroke. Once I was sitting alone in the long beam of silent iron and suddenly had the gradual, complete, unique experience of death. Ellipses. It became amazingly cold. One evening, B and myself, and I think it was the machine fixer, were partaking of the warmth of a bougie hard by and, in fact, between our ambulance beds. When the door opened, a planton entered and a list of names, none of which we recognised, were hurriedly read off, with, as in the case of the last parties, including the wanderer and surplice, the admonition, be ready to leave early tomorrow morning. And the door shut loudly and quickly. Now one of the names which had been called sounded somewhat like broom, and a strange inquietude seized us on this account. Sorry about the sirens in the background. Seems like there's some kind of commotion. I'm sure it'll finish soon. Could it possibly have been B? We made inquiries of certain of our friends who had been nearer the planton than ourselves. We were told that Pete and the trick raincoat and the fighting sheeny and Rocky fella were leaving. About B, nobody was able to enlighten us. Not that opinions in this matter were lacking, there were plenty of opinions, but they contradicted each other to a painful extent. Le Homme were in fact about equally divided, half considering that the occult sound had been intended for B, half that the somewhat asthmatic planton had unwittingly uttered a spontaneous grunt or sigh, which sigh or grunt we had mistaken for a proper noun. Our uncertainty was augmented by the confusion emanating from the particular corner of the enormous room, in which corner the fighting sheeny was haranguing a group of spectators on the pregnant topic, what I won't do to pregni when I get there. In deep converse with Bathhouse John, we beheld the very same youth who, some time since, had drifted to a place beside me at La Soupe. Pete the ghost, white and determined, blonde and fragile, Pete the shadow. I forget who, but someone, I think it was the little machine fixer, established the truth that an American was to leave the next morning. That moreover said American's name was B. Whereupon B and I became extraordinarily busy. The Zulu and Jean Le Negre, upon learning that B was among the partis, came over to our beds and sat down without uttering a word. The former, through a certain shy orchestration of silence, conveyed effortlessly and perfectly his sorrow at the departure. The latter, by his bowed head and a certain very delicate restraint manifested in the wholly exquisite poise of his firm, alert body, uttered at least a universe of grief. The little machine fixer was extremely indignant, not only that his friend was going to a den of thieves and ruffians, but that his friend was leaving in such company as that of C. Crépule, meaning Rockefeller, and Le Duche Mangueux de Blanc, to wit, the trick raincoat and the fighting sheeny, Cest Melhuix. He repeated over and over, wagging his poor little head in rage and despair. It's no place for a young man who has done no wrong to be shut up with pimps and cutthroats. Pour la durée de la gurie, la government française a bien fait. And he brushed a tear out of his eye with a desperate, rapid, brittle gesture. But what angered the machine fixer most was that B and I were about to be separated. Monsieur Jean, touching me gently on the knee, they have no hearts, la commission, they are not simply unjust, they are cruel, savez-vous. Men are not like these, they are not men, they are name of God, I don't want know what, they are worse than the animals, and they pretend to justice. Shivering from top to toe with an indescribable sneer, justice, my God, justice. All of which, somehow or other, did not exactly cheer us up, and the packing completed, we drank together for the last time. Sirens again, I don't know what's going on out there, it sounds like someone's like a high-speed chase, because I keep hearing like a car zooming. Hear that? Fanging it. And then I hear the sirens. That's pretty cool. High-speed chase, bit of excitement for you. The Zulu and Jean Le Negre and the machine fixer and B and I and Pete the Shadow drifted over whiter than I think I ever saw him and said simply to me, I'll take care of your friend, Johnny. And then, at last, it was Lumières, Éteintes, and Leduc. Americans lay in their beds, in the cold, rotten darkness, talking in low voices of the past, of Petrushka, of Paris, of that brilliant and extraordinary and impossible something, life. Morning, whitish, inevitable, deathly cold. There was a great deal of hurry and bustle in the enormous room. People were rushing hither and thither in the heavy half-darkness. People were saying goodbye to people, saying goodbye to friends, saying goodbye to themselves. We lay and sipped the black, evil, dull, certainly not coffee, lay on our beds dressed, shuddering with cold, waiting. Several of Le Homme's, who we scarcely knew, came up to B and shook hands with him and said good luck and goodbye. The darkness was going rapidly out of the dull, black, evil, stinking air. B suddenly realized that he had no gift for the Zulu. He asked a fine Norwegian to whom he had given his leather belt if he, the Norwegian, would mind giving it back because there was a very dear friend who he had been forgotten. The Norwegian with a pleasant smile took off the belt and said certainly. He had been arrested in Bordeaux where he came ashore from his ship. for stealing 3 cans of sardines when he was drunk, a very great and dangerous criminal, he said, certainly, and gave B a pleasant smile, the pleasantest smile in the world. B wrote his own address and name in the inside of the belt, explained in French to the young Pole that any time the Zulu wanted to reach him, all he had to do was to consult the belt. The young Pole translated, the Zulu nodded. The Norwegian smiled appreciatively. The Zulu received the belt with a gesture to which words cannot do the faintest justice. A planton was standing in the enormous room, a planton roaring and cursing and crying, hurry those who are going to go. B shook hands with Jean and Mexique and the machine fixer and the young skipper and bathhouse John, to whom he had given his ambulance tunic and who was crazy proud in consequence, and the Norwegian and the washing machine man and the hat, and many of Lechon, whom we scarcely knew. The black holster was roaring, Alles nom de Dieu, l'Américain. I went down the room with B and Pete and shook hands with both at the door. The other Partis, Alais, the trick raincoat, and the fighting Sheeny were already on the way downstairs. The black holster cursed us, and me in particular, and slammed the door angrily in my face. Through the little peephole I caught a glimpse of them. Entering the street, I went to my bed and lay down quietly in my great pelisse. The clamour and filth of the room brightened and became distant and faded. I heard the voice of the jolly Alsatian saying, Courage, mon ami, your comrade is not dead. You will see him later, and after that, nothing. In front of and on and within my eyes lived suddenly a violent and gentle and dark silence. The three wise men had done their work, but wisdom cannot rest. Probably, at that very moment, they were holding their court in another La Ferté, committing to incomparable anguish some few merely perfected wretched criminals, little and tall, tremulous and brave, all of them white and speechless, all of them with tight bluish lips and large whispering eyes, all of them with fingers weary and mutilated and extraordinarily old, desperate fingers closing to feel the final lukewarm fragment of life glide neatly and softly into forgetfulness. All right, there we go. That's chapter 12 for you, I think. I think that means tomorrow we're starting the final chapter. Would that be correct? Tomorrow's the final chapter? I'm pretty sure. Very exciting stuff. Very exciting stuff. All right. Thank you very much for listening. And I'll see you tomorrow.